The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to my Saturday afternoon program. And I have a guest from Europe today, if we can get him on the air, which is actually what this program time was designed for friends in Europe, so that, you know, because of the time difference, they would be able to be on the programs. Not possible for them to be on a nighttime program. My guest is Hasso Kastrup, the multilingual man who translates revisionist documents into English and other European languages to make them available to more people, a very noble undertaking. His website is at www.showblogger.wordpress.com. It's called Original Translations, a Revisionist Text. And that's spelled S-H-O-A-B-L-O-G-E-R. No H and only one G. .wordpress.com. Very fascinating stuff on there. And you might want to go and take a look at that while I'm looking at my messages, my Skype messages. Okay. So we've got, we've had a problem with making contact between his Skype account, which we thought we had contact with, and this one, and finally Tan Stoffel came along, and he's been working on it, and I hope that I will get a Skype call from Haas in a minute or two. So let me go back to my other page, and let me go back to this page, and continue with the program, and hope that this call comes through. So I wanted to say, and I did have something to say ahead of time. Anyway, I wanted to mention that now, in case I don't remember later, you know, that there is new break music for this show starting today, and it is, Unbekannter Soldat, that's how you pronounce it, Unknown Soldier by Annette, Mueller. And here's a call. Let me quickly answer this call before I continue. This is great. I don't want to get the numbers wrong. There he is. Hello, Hasso.
Yes, I am. Yeah, hi.
Oh, you're here. Okay, very good to hear your nice, soft-spoken voice. I'm always kind of blaring away. So, this is perfect. We've been very busy. I've been very busy for the last half hour, but I feel like I'm worn out already. But no, I'm feeling pretty good. So I was just telling the listeners, I just introduced you, Hasso, but before we go on, I'm telling them about this, our new break music today. And it's by Annette Mueller. It's more German voices, but I've got the, German language song, but I've got the YouTube link and also the words in English on the White Network, on the Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn program page. You go to the White Network website, and under programs on the right side, click on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and on the page that comes up, you'll find information there and the link to the song on YouTube, and also the words in English. And these words were translated were sent to me by Marcus, who is somebody that we know in the comments section, and he also recommended this singer to me. So that takes care of that. And all right, Hasso, welcome, and thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you, and hello, everybody. I can tell you right away what the problem was when we were trying to get a link, a contact. It looks like there are two the White Network Skype accounts, the one which the regular one and the one which is called the Wild wide network testing and development.
Yeah, you're supposed to use call-in. You didn't, you weren't, but you had to have used call-in last time you were on the show.
Yeah, but somehow I did not have it on the list. So I was using the first one, and now I thought that maybe there is another, and I found the other one. So it is working.
Yeah, all right. So that was the only problem. Shame on you, Hostel.
Yes, of course.
Well, it's nice of you to own up to that. Okay, but it's great that we're here now and just in time. And I wanted to, I mentioned your website, and we're going to get back to that and talk about that in detail. But, you know, a lot of news has come up this morning. And it is, just lost my place again. I think that is probably fitting for us to bring up right off the bat because people will be wondering about it. The news that, and the shocking, ridiculous news, that the leaders of the Golden Dawn Party in Greece were arrested some hours ago on charges of being a criminal organization. What does that remind you of? You know, the Nuremberg trials? Their party.
It's more like the arrest of Adolf Hitler in 23, but look how much less they managed to achieve compared with the putsch attempt in 23.
The putsch attempt was one thing with real violence. There's not been any violence by the Golden Dawn. They haven't done anything like that. They're being pressured by the international jury. That's what it is. And the European Union, too, all about the same. And so they found that this was a good pretext. This killing of this anti-racist guy by somebody who was a member of the party. You know, you can't be held responsible for what your membership does on their own, can you? You know, so
of course not.
But they're going to make out, in my opinion, they will make out that the Golden Dawn has been guilty of fomenting violence against immigrants and so on, and people, not non-Greek people and so on. They'll turn it into that. And that this killing was just an example of what it leads to. You know, this one guy somehow, you know, managed, and they were in some kind of a fight. We don't know what all the facts of that were, but he killed this person. So, you know, that's just one sign of the kind of violence that they're fomenting, and they'll make a big thing out. What they'll probably be trying to do is to discourage a lot of the Greek people who've been supporting Golden Dawn or voting for them from continuing, you know, because Andrew Anglin wrote to me this morning, and he said, you know, that the media, well, it's naturally the media campaign, when they put out these media campaigns, they are effective, even though you can see right through them, but they're still effective with a lot of people.
No, it's not only the Greek people, also the other countries of Europe, like Hungary, who have their Jobbik party. Mm-hmm. They are also going to be influenced by it. In general, I think it's Europe is becoming more and more like, you know, Bolshevik or Soviet. Because in my view, the American system or the politic, the world of politics is you can almost say anything, but if you don't have a lot of money, you can't get through to a lot of people. So many people say many things, but it doesn't matter much. But in the Soviet Union, if anyone who dared to express anything, he went straight away to the prison or to the Gulag camp. Mm-hmm. And it's more like this, these arrests. The fuse is very short.
Yeah.
With the European.
You are a European. I don't know if I made that clear to people that they should know. You know, and you've always been in Europe, so you have a better comments on this than I would have. So if you have any more comments you want to make about it?
The Golden Dawn thing?
Okay, well, I just want to point out that this World Jewish Congress President Ronald Lauder, just a few days ago, was in the news making statements that the Greek government had to come down on Golden Dawn and stop what they were doing. And so, you know, now they've done. He's also made a big speech last March. But I just want to mention here some things from what he wrote, what he said in a speech. Greece's democratic forces have a moral obligation to unite against Golden Dawn leaders. That's a direct quote. Especially those who, quote, publicly incite to crimes, preach hate against minorities, deny and belittle the Holocaust, or viciously assault people based on the color of their skin, ethnic background, and political views. This is what Lauder said. Now, you think about what they do. He's head of the World Jewish Congress. You think of what they do in Israel, which he, you know, supports in an extreme way. But that's just one thing. But they bring up the Holocaust amongst these things, that it needs to be a crime to deny and belittle the Holocaust, which it has become, you know, in much of Europe, unfortunately. And then he goes on to say, but it's not in, I don't think it is in Greece. He went on to say that there can be no legitimate place in the Greek parliament for parties whose public statements and actions are racist or anti-Semitic and who operate in many ways like the Nazis did 70 years ago. So again, they bring up the Nazis, which brings up the Holocaust. You know, that's what they're talking about there. And he says, well, this all has to be done for democracy's sake. And then in March, last March, he brought up Holocaust denial again. I'm emphasizing this because we're going to talk about this, as your blog is about this. And he said that the Greek authorities had to take serious and concerted actions against Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, racism, and xenophobia, and implement all relevant laws in that domain. See, so they've been pushing this, you know, and they're not kidding when they make these statements. I mean, they're not just putting out hot air. So now they found the pretext because this one incident where one member of their party, supposedly a member of their party, you know, did something. Yeah. Well, we'll just have to watch developments there. Go ahead.
Yeah. Use the most democratic means to non-democratic means to destroy your democratic opponents. This is what they are doing, and it's also interesting that this demand was made publicly, and there came the demand, and then there came the response, the arrest. Mm-hmm. And it's public. It's like they are trying to show that we do it openly. We can demand
they have
openly.
Clout. And they do have clout.
Yeah.
You know, don't think that they don't. And it's worldwide. It's people. We need to get more and more aware of this power that is. They tell you to be worried about neo-Nazi power. You know, it's their power. That is what needs to be, you know, that is a worry.
No, but what I see is that they more and more openly show that it's them who are in a position to demand and give orders.
Mm-hmm.
It was not presented as an internal Greek decision towards the order came from outside, came from a Jewish center of power.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's been coming from them. They've been, you know, especially Lauder and the World Jewish Congress. They've been in the forefront of the Greek thing. I wonder if they make these decisions or something, you know. Amongst all these organizations, who will take the lead in this thing and who will take the lead in another thing? But they've been consistent with this about Greece. So, and you know, there's a very few Jews in Greece. They pick these countries where they are very sparse, and then they focus on them to try to get more power there because they don't want to be, you know, lose out altogether. There's like about 9,000 Jews in Greece, I think. Very small number, really.
Yes.
But anyway, well, let's go on because now your blog is at I already said what it was.
Showablogger.
Yeah, .wordpress.com. Right, and I tell people how to spell it. Right. Okay. And you started that maybe about a year ago or so, and even less than that, I think. And
yes,
you've been very prolific on it. And you started out with the Holocaust revisionist text, although you just call it, you don't use the word Holocaust in the name of the blog, do you?
Just revisionist text, yes.
Revisionist, yeah, which people associate with that. So you've branched out into also World War II revisionist texts and so on. But you started out, but you agree with me, Hasso, when I say that the number one problem that we need to get rid of for white people to make any headway in our issues today is the Holocaust. And it is the very issue that so many whites and white nationalists too want to avoid and say we can ignore this. We're not going to go up against this. And they even talk like they believe it's, you know, it happened, or they'll say, well, it happened, something happened, and they'll agree that the Jews were terribly treated, and on they go with this stuff. And yet this is the very thing that is most underpinning the power of the Jews today. Would you agree?
I don't know if it's the first or the most important, but it's indispensable. In all this, I think.
I think it's the first. I'm sorry for interrupting already. I think it's the first because it's they always point to it, and if it wasn't there, they would lose all kinds of ability to make these demands that they make. But you go ahead with what you were saying. I'm sorry.
Of course, when I'm saying it's not the first, it's because I think we should act on different fronts simultaneously. And this one is one of these things. It's very important and it's very extremely difficult because all the Western populations have been brainwashed with innumerable films, TV productions to view Nazi Germany as an evil government, instead of so this imprint in the brains is extremely strong. So this is very difficult to cope with this and. Extra much energy must be spent to fight it, and maybe therefore I'm working in this field too, but it's not the only one. The other things are also important.
But if you're talking about World War II history, but there are other issues too that people work on, immigration and, you know, all kinds of things like that, Federal Reserve and, you know, central banks in Europe and so on. So I'm going somewhere to look for something that I should have put up on my I should have opened up sooner, so I'm going to try to get it up here.
I think to make people look at Germany between the wars and during the Second World War, as as a liberation movement instead of an unconditional evil is very difficult, but it's very also very important. That's
right.
What I would.
Okay. Yeah. Well, all these other things that are important, they're all held up by the belief in the Holocaust. Every one of them, and that is the stumbling block for everything. When you get down to the bottom of it,
I'm not sure if it's hold up, if it holds up everything, but I view it as a very important part.
And well, okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stick with that because I think it does, and so I'm going to hold that. But it's probably good that you have a different opinion, so people can think about that. And we're going to take calls in the second hour. And so if you have a brief comment on any of these things that have been brought up, you're welcome to call in. Then the other thing, Hasso, that I don't want to forget that I mentioned you earlier this morning is that this new book that we've been waiting for so long by Carlo Mantogno, Thomas Kues, and Jürgen Graf has just been released on Kodo, the Kodo website. I got a notice in my email box this morning. So it's what did they say, 570 pages, but it's online. They're not going to print it up in a book.
Hmm? I think it was 1,500 pages.
No, it says 570 page long.
Is it?
Online study. 1,500. It might be. Oh, here it is. Here you go. Oh, it is. It's a 1,554-page PDF file. Yeah. And I guess in this PDF file, they got all kinds of indexes and notes, footnotes and so on, and all kinds of extra stuff. So I don't know. They've got a 570-page online study, but you can also go to you can also just download, which I already did, or view the introduction and the table of contents and so on by Jürgen Graf. I'm going to start with that because, I'm not going to plow through all these little detail things the way Carlo Mantogno writes about them, but I will try to get to all of this in one way or another, eventually. But anyway, the good news is that it's all online right from the start, so nobody has to go out and buy the book, and people can take a look at it. And what it is they responded to these four clowns from Holocaust Controversies blog who had written themselves a big, long book disputing what they wrote in their Belzec, Treblinka, and Sobibor books, the research they had done, our three revisionists had done. So they felt compelled to answer all that, but they say that, I thought it was a waste of time, but they say that in doing so, they have got a lot better arguments than they had originally, and they found out a lot of things, and so now they're saying this is their final and complete refutation, and they're not going to do any more, and they're going on to other things, which I hope means the Einsatzgruppen book, which I think is, Jürgen Graf has already started on, and maybe they've all already started on it. So anyway, they explain all why it took so long and all the problems they ran into and so on. So that's also important. Are you going to be reading all of that?
Yes.
You won't have to translate it because I guess they've already taken care of that.
Maybe there are some sources they use that have to be translated.
That's right.
But it's very good. It came and particularly when David Irving is now coming with his videos where he says that the Treblinka and the other Reinhardt camps have been genocidal and that the Einsatzgruppen have been genocidal. It's very good timing, I would say.
Yes, it is. It is very good timing, and it's good that we've got people who are fighting back, and we need to do a lot of fighting back. So I appreciate so much what they all do. Now, So now I got through that thing. What have I got here in my notes? I'll just jump right to, we are going to talk right away about the Ilya Ehrenberg articles you've got here, translations, which, which are the latest ones that you've done. So either by going to the link to the Ilya Ehrenberg page, or just starting out by going to your blog and seeing what's there first. Although they're in backwards order in that case. And if they go to the index on the front page, and then they go to the Ilya Ehrenberg wartime text on one page, then they'll find it from beginning to end, correct?
Yes, yes, yes. They start in 1941, and then I have some from 45 and 44. The last one is from 45, after his visit to East Prussia, after he has seen all the carnage and rapes in East Prussia, and we know that he was criticizing the Red Army for these genocidal practices, but it did not show up in his writings, of course. So his piece about East Prussia is very Talmudic, I would say.
Well, you know, I've told you that I think this man is such a terrible man, and and the stuff he's written is so horrible that at first I didn't read it. I couldn't read it. I started to read it and I just couldn't stand it. But I forced myself to read most of it last night. Once I started really getting into it, it was easier to take. But I looked him up, you know, because I was not real clear about him. Now, first question I have about him, which I didn't get an answer to in looking him up, was why isn't Ehrenberg a German name?
Why is it the German name? Many Jews received German names. Many Polish Jews received German names when, after the last partition of Poland, because after Prussia took the western part of Poland, they wanted to register all the citizens, and Jews did not have last names, and it was the same in Austria, and by the way, and they received the names of towns from which they came, which had something to do with gold or other metals or flowers, like, you know, Goldman or Blumenthal or Rosenbaum. And so this is the origin of the German names of the Jews.
Well, Ehrenberg is some town. Ehren, what is that?
Ehren, it's an honor, and Burg, it's a castle.
Oh, it's a castle, actually.
Yes.
See, so they take these names which are very, conceited, so Honor Castle, they take for their name. Now, all the Jews, others have pointed this out, that they take these very positive sounding words for their names. And I think this one is got, look at now. So if they came from Prussia and they're Jews, they have a German name. So it doesn't really mean they're German. It really just means that they're Jews.
No, it's not. It's not only Prussia, but after the third partition, a large part of Western and Central Poland became part of Prussia, including Warsaw. And some areas east of Warsaw. After the Napoleonic Wars, this part became part of the Russian Empire.
But the point I'm trying to make is that they were not part of any nation, really. They were always just Jews.
Of course.
So he's not, he's got a German sounding name, but his family wasn't German, but his family wasn't Russian. His family wasn't, they were just always just Jews. Would you say?
Yeah. Yes, of course. His father was a businessman, an engineer. Mm-hmm. He was an owner of the biggest beer, how it's called, Brauerei. The factory when you make beer, how it's called?
Brewery.
In English, brewery, yes. He was in family with the owners of the biggest private bank in Russia. So he was there, up there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so, and this Ilya, son Ilya, he was born in 1891. He didn't die until 1967. I always think of him as being, you know, way, way back. Of course, to some people that would be, but not so far back to me. But he was 76 years old when he died. I was hoping he died young, but he is just one liar. You know, I'd like to read a few things about him before you talk about his writings. Not brought up as a religious Jew. It said that he learned no Yiddish, but he edited the Black Book, which was written in Yiddish. So I think he must have known Yiddish. But
he must have known Yiddish because he knew, not least because he knew German well. You know,
he knew German, he could do that work with the Yiddish.
He knew German, he knew French, he was a cosmopolitan.
Right, right. It says that, you know, he understood himself as a Russian, and later as a Soviet citizen, but yet he left all his papers to Israel's Yad Vashem.
Yes, yes, and his summer house where he died, was in a small town outside of Russia, which is called New Jerusalem. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think he was much more attached to his Jewishness than they try to make out, you know, or maybe he tried to make out. When he was 17 years old, he grew up mostly in Moscow. When he was 17 years old, he was arrested. He and he had become friends with Nikolai Bukharin,
yes,
in the Russian revolutionary stuff. And he was arrested by the Tsarist police and kept for 5 months. And then he was allowed to go abroad in exile, and he chose Paris.
Yes, his father took him out on bail, and then he jumped the bail and went to Paris, yes.
See, this is from Wikipedia. See, nothing is, even when you think stuff is giving you, you know, simple facts, it's not. You know, see, it's not, they don't say that. They say that I left out where they say he was beaten by the secret police and he was had some teeth missing or something. They're not sure. There's no, you know, there's no sources for this stuff. They just put it in there. And then they say they allowed him to go abroad, and he chose Paris. Well, that's not what happened at all.
No,
his father bailed him out. So his father with all his money and Jewish influence. So then he, but anyway, he wrote, as you have pointed out, he wrote the article Kill in 1942, and it says that here on Wikipedia. What people think was first was written for 45, right?
Yes, yes, 44.
Yeah, but it was written in 42, and then it was brought out again in 44, 45. Well, some of this I don't see what else.
His writings have been printed and reprinted. Some of them were originally articles in the Soviet newspapers, some of them were leaflets from the start. And they have been, of course, reprinted and sent to the soldiers. But he was by far not the only propagandist. He was one of many. But
right.
I found a quote from Molotov, which says that Ehrenburg is worth several divisions.
Yeah, Molotov. Well, we call it Molotov. There you go. And I was going to ask you now, are these propaganda documents that you found, and you've translated a few of them only. You say there's like 200 of them. And I'm thinking, oh, I hope you don't translate any more of them. This is enough. Because I think this guy is just spewing lies. And it's amazing how even when people know, when they read things, they tend to believe, you know, it's into their mind. They tend to believe what they're reading.
Of course it's lies, but I thought it was good to get people acquainted with what was influencing the Soviet army in those horrible days of 44, 45, when they entered the German territory, to get people acquainted with this, you know, with how people, how certain people influence nations and armies in certain moments, historical moments, like 1939 in Poland, for example. The whole nation became glowing white nationalistic and bound for war with Germany, and it was no accident. This feeling and this hatred of Germany, Germans, of Hitler, was created consciously by the media. That's part of my of what I'm myself trying to understand and to make people understand.
Okay.
Examples.
Okay. Yeah. So these propaganda documents, so many of which were written by Ehrenberg, and then, as you said, so many more written by other writers, and they had all the writers, you know, working on, even though they were doing other writing at the time, I guess they were also churning out these propaganda pieces. So have they all been published in Russian? Are they all in Russian? And were they all used during the time of the war? But they just haven't been translated. Nobody wanted to translate them into another
language. I don't know. I did not make a specific study of what is available, what is not. Ehrenberg was the most known. So I'm translating him. There's Soviet Union had not only 24,000 tanks and 15,000 airplanes, but they had also many newspapers and very many writers. So they have probably not everything is available, and probably not everything, not all the most explicit works of Ehrenberg are available either. I'm working with what I have.
Well, what strikes me is that it's just, he writes this fiction. It's like, it's supposed to be real, but it's like bald-faced lies. And it brought to mind, just, well, you know, what I'm familiar with, is that Walter Langer, that Jew who is the brother of William Langer, who was working with American military intelligence during the war, and one of the things he's famous for is his psychological profile of Adolf Hitler, you know, mm-hmm. in which he just made stuff up and just wrote every kind of thing he could dream up, you know, as a psychologist, you know. And Ehrenberg is writing about the Germans and how they behave, the soldiers and so on, and giving incidents and telling about, oh, what some woman said and so on. And, you know, it's just all an invention.
Yeah,
he's just inventing it, and it gets pretty darned awful.
It is awful. It is awful. He had a genocidal mindset. This man. I have a quote from his fiction book from 1921, when he says, "To kill is a unpleasant necessity." I'm translating now. It's a dirty work without celebration and pleasure. To for the good of humanity, you can kill a crazy old man or 10 million people. There is only a quantitative difference. But killed you have, and otherwise all these stupid soulless lives will continue. It's from 1921. And so he was just continuing his work. I think his attitude to German people, whom he knew, he was in Berlin, he lived in Berlin for a couple of years in the 20s and once in the 30s. He was not successful in Berlin, but he had friends there. But the way he is writing about Germans, it's very special. He's comparing them with bacteria, with baboons, with scorpions, a curse, rabid wolves, criminals, robots.
Criminals and robots, really. Yes. I mean, he really tries to point out that they have no feeling or care for anybody. They just go around killing people. You know, they take whatever they want, and just things that we know are absolutely not true. That's true of, you know, the opposite types.
Yes.
From the Germans.
You know, really, we know that there is a notion in the Yiddish, it's called Goyischer Kopf. It's a Gentile head. It's a notion for a Gentile. It's a stupid man. He's just a Gentile head, an idiot. But this one he translates into his description of the German population, which he met in Prussia. He's describing, for example, a museum in one small town where there is some idiotic exhibits. The towns where there is no libraries, private homes where the only books are just Mein Kampf and some other propaganda which nobody reads, but it looks good together with the porcelain. And so yeah. It's very Talmudic.
Well, and you know, he's even quoting Adolf Hitler, saying things that he never said. He must be, you could say he's taken if the best of it, he's taken some comments or things from Hitler, maybe from Mein Kampf, and then he's translated them wrongly, you know, so outrageously that he's got something altogether different. That's what I think. What do you think about that? Because you've got quite a few of these where he's talking about Hitler.
I can only say that he's using everything he can. He was a very talented propaganda man, and anything goes. But
he's got one quote here from Mein Kampf. He says, Hitler says, "I am liberating man from the degrading chimera called conscience."
But there were two after the war. He himself was trying to wash his image, to regain his good name among the Western writers circles, and so he after his visit to his tour to Prussia, he was reportedly criticizing the leadership of the Red Army for their behavior, for these rapings and lootings and everything. And on the other side, also after the war, he wrote together with Vasily Grossman, another Jewish writer and propagandist. They wrote a book called The Black Book of Soviet Jewry, where they essentially created the large part of the the present myth of the Holocaust. And for this, they have been criticized that the book was not published in the Soviet Union. The manuscript was taken, was, despite the wishes of the Soviets, has been stolen away to the Palestine and then published there. I have a quote from a head of propaganda department of the Communist Party from 1947, where they say it was a time when Stalin reportedly turned against the Jews in the leadership. He says the book, especially the first section relating to the Ukraine, creates a false impression of the true nature of fascism and its organizations. The common thread throughout the book leads to the conclusion that the Germans looted and destroyed only the Jews. The reader cannot help the impression that the Germans fought against the Soviet Union only to destroy the Jews. In relation to the Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, Lithuanians, and Latvians, and other nationalities of the Soviet Union, the Germans allegedly treated them leniently. In many stories, they emphasize that in order to be safe, it was enough to buy a Russian passport and not to look like a Jew, etc.
Who was writing this?
It was the chief of propaganda department of the Central Committee. It was his comments to the Black Book of Soviet Jewry. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, he's not liking it because the Black Book is making it look like
it was only Jewish.
Just after the Jews. Yeah.
Another interesting quote from the period when they tried to destroy Ehrenburg is from one called Abakumov, and he says in March 45 he complained before it was not part of the comment. The Soviet intelligence chief Abakumov reported to Stalin. In addition, Ehrenburg said the returning Russians as from the forced labor look good, the girls are dressed well and well fed. His articles are not appropriate for the soldiers. His description of the situation of enslaved persons deported to Germany are not convincing, and he recommended an action against Ehrenburg to be initiated.
Well, you're always in danger in the Soviet Union, weren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, yes. Somebody's going to turn against you at any time, and you didn't get much leeway either.
It was very, very risky. After the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact in August 39, he was in Paris at that time. He was so confused and scared that he lost reportedly 20 kilograms. And he did not know what will happen to him. He did not know what was going on.
Oh.
So, but in 1940, when the German army took France, he was trying to escape. But the French authorities and also those at the border did not let him go because they had something about him. He did not pay his taxes, and they stopped him.
on the
border, and the only thing for him to do was to escape to the Soviet embassy, which he did. And he was transported to the Soviet Union afterwards.
Put to work.
Yes.
He was useful then, and he went right to work for them. Well, you know, one thing I've noticed, Hasso, when I was reading all this Ehrenberg stuff, is that it's a cleaner, better translation than some of your German translations. I mean, it's like perfect. So I was wondering if Russian is easier to translate into English, or is it a less complicated language, or
it's
something?
It's somehow, I don't know why, it's easier to just, you know, almost, it goes like word for word. The construction of the sentences is easier. Maybe also it's because, you know, Ehrenberg is writing for simpler people, and his language is simpler.
Mm-hmm. That's why. Probably both of those things. But that's interesting, because I know there's the construction of German is so different from the construction of English, and I don't know, whatever other languages. How many languages, by the way, are you able to deal with?
The Scandinavian, Germanic, you know, Swedish, Norwegian, and Danish, and then Russian, and Polish, and German, and
not Spanish or
and the French. Yes.
Yeah, I thought you could do French. Yeah, because you translate Vincent Renoir's things. So that's a lot. That's really, you're really quite amazing. Amazes me.
I can do some Dutch, but it's not easy. I don't really know Dutch, but it reminds very much of German and Scandinavian languages. It's like a mixture of these, with some admixture of English too. So I did something for you about this Jewish man from, I don't remember what his name was. The survivor.
The Albin? No. What are you talking about? Something that you translated for me?
Yes. There was some Dutch text, but I don't do it.
Oh, yeah. Otherwise. Well, yeah. Of course, it's true. The more languages you know, the more other languages you know you can figure out. So
sure.
All right. I wanted to ask you before we're going to go to our. Well, we've still got quite a few minutes here, but let's see. Okay. Well, is there anything more? We've got this. This interesting story about Vincent Renoir. Maybe I'll bring this up now. We can go back to Ehrenberg if somebody might call in and ask some questions about it or something too, in the second hour. So we're going to go on to, this interesting thing from, Vincent Renoir, who did a video chastising this French friend of, Robert Faurisson, that Negro man, Dieudonné, Mabala, Mabala, how do you pronounce his name?
Dieudonné.
Okay, he is a kind of a Holocaust denier, but like so many Holocaust deniers, he's not wanting to defend Hitler and his government and Goebbels. So, he wrote a petition against this LICRA organization, which is a committee against against racism and anti-Semitism thing.
Yes,
France.
It's French ADL.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Very, very aggressive, and saying that it should be dissolved. It should be made illegal, I guess. Because they use the same, let me get the part that you've translated for me. Their tactics resemble that of Hitler and Goebbels. They take from writers, artists, the right to express themselves, and later, also their right to live. And Renoir answered that he's French too, of course, they're both French. He answered that Mbala is a French citizen. In a video, and said that this was a suicidal tactic because it gives LICRA more power by reinforcing the Holocaust myth. And that is very true. And this is something we run into so often with so many people. they're fighting against the Jews or fighting against Israel or something, and then they want to liken them to what they might call the Nazis or Hitler, and in this case Hitler and Goebbels, and you know, and say that they were doing that, and well, Vincent makes this excellent point that it's counterproductive, you know, and you can't reinforce the Holocaust. You can't do away with the what the Jews are doing by ever reinforcing the Holocaust, which goes back to what I was saying earlier in the program. What do you want to comment on that? I got some information about this Lycra. It's interesting, but it's probably too much to go into.
Yes, many people do it, of course, because they know, and that people are brainwashed, and they have this idea in the head that the Nazi period was just one huge crime, and they just use it in their own argumentation, but as Vincent is showing it, it's a crazy tactic, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. Well, you know, we don't have as much time as I thought. It's at 30 seconds. So I want to point out, though, that I titled this program Our Fight Against the Falsification of History, and then I failed to mention it. And I think that we are talking about, with Hassel's blog, about the falsification of history, which is really
sad. Erinnert an deine Qual, keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe, treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich wünschte, ich hätte ein Gespräch, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben, nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich. Ungebrochener Held, ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedachte zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer da noch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld hier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter. Ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Bis an der Zeit, übernimmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht. Für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme. Ich darf zu dir sprechen. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen. Ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich höre eine Stimme, sanft zu mir spricht, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that new break music really snuck up on me. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and my guest is Hasso Kastrup. Do you pronounce your name Hasso or Hasso?
Hasso.
Hasso, okay. And he's just a fantastic fellow, in my opinion, and he does all this great translating work, which is very important. Now, I wanted to ask you one more thing: are you having any trouble finding new Holocaust revisionist texts to translate, or do you just like to branch out and do different things so because you get tired of doing Holocaust all the time?
It's not because I'm tired of the Holocaust, but the most known and most important texts are getting translated right away, but I think there are some works which have not been translating when they came out and forgotten and unjustified, and I'm finding those and translate them, those who have been forgotten, because you know the news stream is going very very fast and there are some pearls left on the way and I'm gathering them and finding them, but of course it's also true that dealing with the Holocaust is difficult and it's also emotionally so. I'm doing what interests me, and the Second World War is what interests me. The circumstances around September 1st, 39, about June 22nd, 41. They are very interesting moments, very crucial moments in history.
Well, right, and they need a lot of revisionism. And you have done a lot. And you being, you are, to remind people, you are half Polish and half German. And so, and you grew up in Poland. So you naturally have a lot of interest in the conflict between Germany and Poland. And you've done a lot of translating. Very good texts about that, which are not pro, on the Polish side at all. You do have one translation by someone who is, and I don't think you've got it in your index because it's not exactly World War II. It's at Richard Lucas.
Richard Lucas,
his book. Yes. But for the most part, these are revisionists that are trying to give look at things more from the point of view of the Germans. And you've done this Alfred Schickel, secret documents. You've done lately the latest one, The Diabolical Trap. That is written by a German who is to blame for the outbreak of the Second World War. And there's a few others that you've done. We talked about this subject last time you were on, and it's endlessly interesting, yeah. Actually. There's a lot that can be said about it. Let's see, some of your most recent ones was, this is all Ehrenberg. Everything along the side here is Ehrenberg. But how would you, the one that I read was The Diabolical Trap, Who's to Blame for the Outbreak of the Second World War. And it is, it says it's written, it's translated from the German. It is, said the guy, it's Thies Christofferson, but I don't know if he's the author. He says the author is an Austrian.
No, he was an editor.
Okay.
He had a kind of monthly or a quarterly issued, published in Denmark, where he also lived, and but this one is by an Austrian, who is not mentioned by name because he could not be mentioned by name, and it's just a good summation of the last days before, last months before the start of the war. I say.
Well, it is, and you know, I think the most interesting part for me is after September 1st, when the Wehrmacht went into Poland, because they did not get any response to their request for a diplomat to come talk to them about these issues, and they had been given a lot of misdirection. You can blame it on a lot of people, the English, the British, mostly the English and the Poles, I think. I don't know how much the French were involved in all of that. But, and the Americans were involved in it. And then they were told that, Britain was going to declare war on them unless they pulled out. You know, it wasn't immediately that Britain said, well, we've declared war on you. They had to pull out and come back out from Poland. And according to what Vincent Renoir said, on the last time he was on my program, he said he researched into that, and there's a lot that he found that has never been written anywhere, I guess, or they don't write it. And I think maybe some of these people don't know about it. I don't know, I'm asking you about it, but he said that Hitler agreed to that. And then they changed it a little bit, and Hitler agreed to that. And they said, well, you have to pay reparations and, you know, for what damage you've done so far. And Hitler agreed to that. And then they finally, you know, they didn't really want an agreement from Hitler. They wanted to declare war. And so this is the British, pushed by the Americans. So finally, they demanded something, I forget now what it was, unfortunately, from Hitler that was outrageous and that he couldn't agree to. And he didn't, and that was the end of the so-called negotiations that were going on. And some of this is kind of alluded to. This is alluded to somewhat in this article, isn't it?
Yeah. The 2nd of September, it was the initiative of Mussolini, proposed an immediate ceasefire. And I'm reading from the text. He proposes an immediate ceasefire followed by a conference to resolve the German-Polish dispute. The French government immediately responds positively. But the French government, with the hot iron in the ass, rejects the Italian mediation. It's a reference to to the quotation from Joseph Kennedy, who said that Ambassador who said that Roosevelt wanted him to put hot iron in Neville Chamberlain's ass to prod him to war.
Yeah, well, now, you know, I wonder if you, I'm going to question you on that hot iron. The way I always read it was that I think Roosevelt told Kennedy to tell the Poles and maybe the French to put some iron up their spine. I don't know why it would be hot. I mean, it wasn't hot. It was just...
It was hot iron. This quotation appears also in the book The Backdoor to War by how was his name? I don't remember. An American historian and Congress member who actually heard it. So Hitler agreed to a ceasefire and agreed to pay reparations, agreed to the participation of Poland in this new Munich. But so then the English did not want to talk about it, so mm-hmm. they had to continue.
Well, they finally made a request, you know, added to their request, and was something that Hitler couldn't agree to. Because the point, which only proves the point that they intended war with Germany from way back, you know, from much earlier than this anyway, and this was their pretext, just like we were talking about the pretext of the Greek government to arrest the Golden Dawn leaders. You know, they need to find a pretext.
And the pretext to strike against Syria, you know, they are just waiting for something suitable. Mm-hmm. It was just like before the First World War, when there had been a whole series of crises, Morocco crisis first and second, and at last there was something which they succeeded in, and it was the murder in Sarajevo. But there have been many attempts before that. So when something is planned to happen, almost anything is good enough to act as a trigger. And in this case, Poland was the trigger.
Well, so is it your conclusion that Germany was forced into this, and they're kind of tricked into it and pushed into it, and the Poles cooperated with the English and the Americans in doing this?
The Poles did cooperate, I think, because first the public opinion has been prepared very carefully and was in a state of hysteria. It was done by the press. And on the other side...
The Polish press.
The Polish press in let's say, in not necessarily Polish hands.
Okay. And then, Jewish hands?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and the Poles were, by the same kind of hysteria, they were going after Germans and acting bolder and bolder in their persecution of Germans
It's not only a question of persecution, but it's a question of let them come. You know, they are horrible. The war is inevitable anyway. And on the other side, the ruling elite has been prepared by quietly telling them that that Germany is going to be crushed anyway. It has been planned. You have the choice to be on the right side, on the one our side, or you can go down together with Germany. So they made this apparently rational choice. But if it was rational, I don't know. on the side of Hitler, I'm not sure if, you know, it's very difficult to be wise in the rear mirror, but if he necessarily needed to take the Czechoslovakia, if he necessarily needed to have Danzig and the corridor in 39, I'm not sure. I'm not so sure. Because he knew that the West and influenced very much by the Jewish opinion was against him, and he apparently voluntarily walked into the strap.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Czechoslovakia, if you know, they, what happened was that they got the Sudetenland, and then then other countries took parts that they wanted, and nobody stopped them. And that included Poland, which was happy at that particular point in time. Yes. That was just in 1938. And who else? Slovakia broke away, and somebody else took something. Was it Ukraine?
Hungary took it part.
Hungary. That's right. And then there wasn't much left. And then it seemed like this was kind of not a good situation for Germany, so they just decided to take over the rest of it as a protectorate, so that they wouldn't have this weak Czech nation that could be taken over maybe by Russia or something like that.
But after this explicit promise to Chamberlain and essentially the whole world that he was satisfied, that he was not going to take, he was only interested in German territories, and he takes. It doesn't matter how it's called, protectorate or autonomic republic or anything. For the world, for the press, he took Czechoslovakia. He took the next step towards war. For me, from my point of view today, it was probably a mistake.
Well, that's the sticking point then there. Is the taking over the rest of the Czech territory. And was that territory always Czech territory? Wasn't all of that territory German Teutonic at one time?
It was not Czech. It was from time immemorial. It was part of the you can say of German Reich, of the Habsburg Empire, but it doesn't matter so much if it was part of the Roman Empire of German nation. It doesn't matter so much for the propaganda for the Europe. It was Hitler's another step on his way to conquer the world.
Well, that's right. That's how they portrayed it.
Yes.
But I do believe that after the invasion of Poland, they got back Danzig so they were separated from Prussia. I think that was the end. That would have been the end, but that was too much for the Anglo-Americans.
Maybe not. There's a quote from...
Oh, well, that's true. He wanted to go into the Ukraine and go into Russia.
There's a quote. Right. There's a quote somewhere. It was a speech of Hitler in a beer hall where he says, "I'm grateful to those fools, Polish colonels, who did not agree to my proposals, because in that case I would not have been able to attack the Soviet Union, which was preparing a deadly blow to Europe."
Well, yeah, he did say things like that afterwards, yes, but I don't think it was in a beer hall, was it? Was he still giving speeches in beer halls?
I think it was a beer hall. I'm not sure.
Really?
I think it was a beer hall speech. It doesn't 40? Matter, but it was just the way he thought about it.
Well, when he thought the way he talked later, was, and I don't know if this might have been, you know, to make it look good or not, but was like, well, in hindsight, you know, I wouldn't have done this, but in hindsight, I'm glad it happened this way, because he was now thinking that his plan, his long range plans were just coming about faster, you know, yes. And they were just caught up, they were in it, they were doing it, and he was pretty confident during, you know, 41, 42, that's about it, I guess. But
he made, yep.
Go ahead.
He made many such remarks in hindsight.
Yes.
There is a conversation with Marshal Mannerheim of Finland, which recorded secretly by Finnish radio people when Hitler met with Mannerheim in Finland, where Hitler says, "Had I known that the Soviets had so many tanks, I would never have dared to attack them."
You know, right. Yeah, that's right. Well, that's absolutely correct. And somebody's, I just answered a call, so if somebody's on the line, say hello.
Yeah. Hello, Carolyn.
Yeah. Okay, hold on a minute. Who's calling? What's your name?
Russell calling.
Sorry, Russell, you're not allowed to call, and you know that. So, please hang up. All right.
No,
you're not allowed to call here, Russell. So please hang up. I wanted to say something that, about what we were just talking about. But I took the call, and I'm really pretty pissed off now. But I was going to say that, what were you saying, Hasso, about, it was something about, table talk. It was in table talk, and I'd like to discuss that a little bit as we go on. There was a, he said a lot of things like that in table talk. But, you know, he's talking around the table. He's talking to his intimate friends and associates and so on, his fellow Germans, and he's going to say a lot of things. When I think about what I might say while I'm sitting around after dinner conversation with people and how different that would be from what I would say officially, you know, wanting people to hear about, there's a lot of things you might say. Although I don't deny that he believed him. You know, he was saying what he really felt and believed, but he wouldn't.
Maybe.
Out there, I think in large part. Well, let's okay. If we can't get old Russ off, Russell, if you're still there, ask your question real quick.
Thank you, Carolyn. Again, I would like. I'm not an academic in this field.
Well, that's a problem. You never know what you're talking about, but ask it real quick.
Yeah, it's just a question that I'm asking. You know, that's why I'm asking, because I'm not an expert. What I wanted to ask is, after World War II, my father was in World War II, and after the war, he brought four Czechoslovakian fellows to America. I guess they call them, I forget, deportees or something like that. Anyway, they always spoke about their fear, and what they hated was the communists, and they would all say that the communist and the Jew is the same thing. And I'm just curious, when you talk about how Germany, you know, took over part of Czechoslovakia and all that, I'm curious, why wouldn't these guys be angry at Germany and express that? Why was it that they always talked about the communists and the Jews?
How so? You want to answer that?
I think it's again a question of propaganda. The Czechs had a much better life under Germany than under the Soviet rule after the war. That is my answer.
Okay. Well, I hung up the call. So I didn't think it was going to be a question that led anywhere. So we were going to talk about... sorry, I got upset there at that guy. We were going to talk about table talk now. I've been reading it. I think it's just fantastic. And And you are the one who, you know, I was asking you, and you were very nice to continue answering my questions about, you know, that I kept insisting that it was not a good translation, and probably, it was messed around with by these English, and all about mostly in the realm of Christianity and so on. And you kept saying, no, I've looked at it all. I don't see anything wrong with it. And I kept thinking, well, are you comparing it to the German, you know, by Heim and Picker? Or are you just looking at that, you know, what that was taken from? Anyway, you kept trying to explain to me, and finally I got it, and I realized that. And then I went and read what David Irving had to say about it, and he said the same thing. So I thought, well, there's, you know, I've been wrong about thinking that this English translation, Trevor Roper edited book, was not accurate, you know, and shouldn't be trusted, because I think now the whole thing is accurate, and I think it's a very, very interesting. Have you read the whole thing?
I have not. I have read the whole English text for a long time ago, and I have. The Heim's book, when it's from my edition, is from 88, no, from 80, and I have the Picker book. The Heim and Picker were those two men who wrote down what Hitler was saying, and mm-hmm. Most of what Picker has overlaps with Heim's text, and what I did was to take small parts from the English text and compared them to both books in German, and the translations are good. They are good, and you can say maybe there was a conspiration between Heim and Picker, but from what we know, the only thing that went on between Heim and Picker, or the publishers, was a war who has the rights to publish it in Germany and the rest of the world, and it's not so much a text, the question of the text, because there is nothing world shaking or in the text. It's very interesting, but it's not strategic importance. So the translation, the English translation, I would say is good, and it can be considered as the word of Hitler.
I think so. That's very good. I appreciate that. And you know, you can always, when you take quotes out of context, you can always make them sound worse than the way they sound when they're in context, right?
So oh, sure.
These you people have... will make all these quotes about Christianity, and it sounds like, wow, he was really railing against Christianity and hated it, when he was mostly just discussing why he himself didn't find any need for it anymore. Go ahead.
There is, for example, at one point in the table talks, there is Hitler says that he will have to exterminate the Jews, and then you have to take the whole sentence. If they he's talking about the emigration, and then he says if they don't want to go voluntarily, we'll have to exterminate them. It's in English. Mm-hmm. Then in the German text, it says much about, but it's the same, and it uses the word ausrotten. Ausrotten. Mm-hmm. And the term ausrotten, you can say, okay, we can translate it as exterminate, but the origin of the word ausrotten is from the word rot, which means root. it's which you can translate as uproot and, you know, mm-hmm. throw away. Mm-hmm. And there you have Vincent Renouard's text. In one of his texts, he says that extermination, it's from exterminus, terminus. It's a border. It's to throw out on the other side of the border. You know this, but it doesn't matter. The context of the whole conversation is that if they don't want to go voluntarily, we'll have to help them. That's
right.
It.
Right.
So
right.
You cannot say it's translated wrongly, but the common use of extermination now is like it's just to kill them, but it's not what he meant. It is obvious when you take the whole sentence also in the English translation.
Well, what are we going to do about all these the power of the Jewish media to put out their story and to convince people that this is the truth? Because again, all right, you know, I think that the title of the show today of let me bring that other thing up here again, we need to fight for our against the falsification of history and true history. And we've got so many great people who are doing that and have done it, but we have a minute audience compared to the mass audience that the liars have. And, you know, I used that picture. I had a picture of a book burning, you know, up and burning in flames. But then I saw this picture of these two young white kids, and they looked so hopeless. And I thought, that's exactly what it is. So I'm using it, even though it's depressing. But I used it, and I think I'll continue to use it for this show. That you might not like it, but, you know, that when we don't have our real history, we don't have any, we don't have our identity. I mean, we just have lost, we can't continue ourselves without having our, knowing what our history is. If it's deformed and defaced like it's been. And then we have these, arguments amongst us, like we're just talking about with the Germans and the Poles and all the Russians and the Slavs against the Germanics and so on, or, you know, whose truth is going to be there, who's going to have their truth. And you think that if we would find the real truth, nobody would be destroyed by it, but people want to exalt themselves, you know, what they want to do. So I think this is the bigger problem that we're facing. Is our loss of historical truth or our own history?
Of course, there are very, very real problems, historical problems. Let's take the blood, the Brombery Blood Sunday, the Polish version of this event, which happened on the 3rd of September, is completely different from the German one. And at the present moment, I can't say which version is closer to the truth. But as for now, that's a detail of history. What we have to achieve is to make our you know, European stuff get viral on the net. You know,
Which European stuff is it? Because there are different versions that are all European.
You're right. But all of them are not getting viral. You know, there is so much stupidity which the moment it appears on YouTube or anywhere on the internet, it's going viral. It's within a couple of days. It has millions of hits. But nothing of what we are doing which is of in many cases of a very good value, is getting viral. So not so long ago, there was American veteran who had a very good, he made a very good video where he very beautifully explained the dangers for the white race, which are in the particular in America. But he got thousands, but it's far from millions. He had it right. Everything which he said was well done, and there was, you know, there was a sense of urgency in what he said. There was anger in what he said, but it's still only thousands. We have to achieve the situation where what our talented people say is getting viral by itself, and then people who get attracted to this material are going to take up and read other things. And I'm not hoping now to get viral with what I'm doing, but I'm just preparing the material for the moment when it's going to become important and necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Well, that's what a lot of people are saying. That they're saying, "Well, I'm preparing all this now, and I hope that it will become more popular later on." And that, of course, that's very important. But let's say, to talk about this conflict between Europeans and what we believe, and why I think the biggest problem is the gang up on the Germans and National Socialists for saying that, for being the evil characters in history, is what's holding up everything. And here's a good example. We were talking about the Golden Dawn Party, and you know, they've been pushing along what they call social nationalism, which is supposed to be a disguised form of national socialism. They've been gaining, you know, a lot of supporters and so on. But the opponents in Greece say that, remind the Greeks that the Nazis sent them to concentration camps, you know, where they were killed and gassed and so on. But they don't say that these were Jews, or maybe some kind of criminals. And they also, and then they say they killed Greeks. Oh, the national, Germans, Wehrmacht came into Greece and they killed how many thousands and 100,000 or whatever, I don't know the number now, Greeks. And you want to see this party, a party like this come alive now, you know, we don't want anything like this. These are Nazis, you know, the Nazis did this. This is the problem. This is the problem. It's never going to stop being a problem with anything that's any party or any effort that's good for us and not good for the Jews and the communists, as long as the Nazis are seen, or even the National Socialists or the Germans or the Wehrmacht or the Third Reich, or however you want to name it. I don't like using that Nazi name anymore, but as long as that holds that, oh, they really are responsible for all the things that happen. And basically, it was just the Jews that they wanted to get out of and as the German, it's true, as the German occupied territory and the German Reich and whatever grew, then there was a larger area that they had to get the Jews out of. So I don't think there should be any sympathy for Jews, considering everything that we know today and what they're even in current time doing to us. What they've done to the United States is just atrocious, and it's the evidence is everywhere, and yet people still want to defend the Jews. Explain that. Even Poland wants to defend their Jews. A lot of the people don't want to, but the Poland does. The Greek government does. Every government. And most of the people who have any business people or, you know, anybody with any position there insist on doing that.
True. But then the political elite of Poland is incorporated, you can say, in the New World Order or whatever you want to call it. What I would like to ask you, and maybe ask the listeners, is there any chance to fight professional propaganda with you know, just the truth? Is it enough to tell the truth in order to get people to forget the lying propaganda, or is it necessary to be just as propagandistic and professional or is it necessary to brainwash from the other side?
Well, that's very good question, Hasso. I really appreciate you bringing that up and putting it the way you did. I think that's outstanding. And my answer to that now is no, it's not possible. At one time, I would have wanted to show some idealism and say, oh, yes, the truth will win out. Oh, we have to believe in the... And the truth is important. I don't think we should lose our faith in the truth. I believe in the truth, but I know that it's not going to win out over this professional propaganda, because it never has, it seems to me. And so, and if we... What was that you said? If we can do what they do, it's power. What I want to say is that what counts is power, and power is also who is in control of all the means that you used to talk about, the means of production, but now we can also say the means of communication.
Yes.
You know, if you're not in control of the means of communication, you're not going to get your story out. And we have allowed this. It just makes me so angry. But I was a part of it too, and I didn't understand anything that was happening. We have allowed all this to be taken over. The means of production, the means of government, the means of communication, and the means of money, financial elements, all of this to be taken over by Jews. And people, if you think that's going too far, I just don't see, you know, it's all Jews running it all. And they have their way. So we have somehow really missed the boat here, and it's very, very late. I don't know, truthfully, whether we can ever take hold, if we can ever fight this off. But it would take an awful lot of awareness from an awful lot of people who are... That's all it would take, would be people changing their mind about who's responsible for what happened. How long can they keep blaming Adolf Hitler? Well, They find new Adolf Hitlers, and they're also good guys, most of them. So, I'm not encouraged about that question.
They have a new Adolf Hitler for every situation. Mm-hmm. It's good that we have the truth on our side, but it's not enough. I think it's not enough, and there has been discussion about it in the Occidental Observer. There is one of the writers from Yugoslavia. I think it's, I don't know what he wrote some books, and his main idea was that what we are doing needs to be very attractive.
See, but I don't agree with that, because let me just throw this in here while you're thinking. I don't agree with that, because what they mean by attractive is to leave out things like Hitler and the Third Reich. Leave all that out to make it, try to appeal to people without saying the bad words. Don't even talk about Jews too much. That's and what then, they mean. Huh?
And then we are returning to this, to Vincent Renoir and his video about this black man, Donadieu, who used Hitler and Holocaust as an argument against the Jews. It's not good. But there is something about it. It's so deep in human subconscious that the Holocaust happened and the Hitler was bad, that it's almost impossible.
I don't think it's so deep. I mean, I didn't question it at all. And I remember, I've said this before, but I remember a time, it was back in the 70s, when a woman who worked for me in this office that I was managing, brought it up because it was something, it was during the time of those TV special, and said that it never happened, and I was shocked, and I thought, of course it happened, you know, it didn't even, what she said, and she said a few things, but I don't know, not much, but it didn't make any impression on me whatsoever. So, I mean, I would not even question it at that time, but then eventually it came around, because of what I was seeing on the internet and so on, that I did. And the internet allows you to gather so much information and get so much. So I do think that the internet is very good for it. And I do think, I'm sounding like a broken record, but that we need to attack the Hitler myth, the Nazi myth, and the Holocaust myth head on. Head on. Sure. I think we have to do that, and we have, our people are not willing to do that.
Sure. There are those who, you know, we have to specialize. You know, we don't need to do the same thing, all of us. Some of us are destroying the myth, of course. Some of us are working with the new parties and taking care of the politics of today. It's a specialization, but we don't need to work against each other, like Donadieu did. He it's good of Vincent Renoir to criticize him because he shouldn't have used Holocaust and Germany as an example of evil. So. I think specialization is very good, and I also think that making our message more attractive is very important because.
Well, how do we make it more attractive? What is the way of doing that? What I interrupted you there, and so maybe this writer who I didn't read this was telling us what he meant by making it more attractive.
You'll have to. It's long ago. I've been reading it. His name is Alex Kurtagic.
Kurtagic. Oh, I don't like him. I'll just tell you that. I know he writes stuff like that. He writes all this stuff like that. He's very popular in a whole area of people there, and popular in Europe. And there are some of these Europeans, Hasso, I don't like the ones who are like him. There's a lot of them I do like Vincent and a lot of them. But Gunther. And Gunter's planning. I'm planning on having Gunter on in October, listeners. He's been too busy up until then to come on to talk about the German elections. And we should turn to that in a moment. You see, well, then what did Alex say? How you go about that? He is an anti-Hitler, anti-Holocaust person. I mean, don't talk about it. That's what he is. You know, he's not interested.
I'm just saying about the idea. It needs to go to not only to the conscious but also to the subconscious. But okay, I've bought one of his books. I could not read it. I read the first chapter and then I threw it away. But the idea is good. The idea is important.
Yeah, the idea to make it more attractive is good. But when we think about how to make it more attractive, you have to throw out the truth. You have to throw out too much truth. And what you end up with is something that in the long run is not going to help us. You know, so all you're pushing, you're in a sense, you're going to be helping the enemy because you're going to push something on. You know, you're going to spend we're going to spend our efforts promoting ideas that are not going to be really help us in the end. It might temporarily make people, you know, listen to you or something, but I don't know. I guess it was like Hitler himself said when he was still struggling, you know, in the 20s and so on, that they were not going to compromise on what they knew was right. And they were called upon to do that quite a bit, you know, and they could have probably gotten into some governments, you know, as a minor partner or something. They weren't going to do that. They wouldn't even join and merge with other parties that they didn't 100% agree with. To make a, you know, a stronger showing or something. They just stayed independent and he finally won through. But he always said that, you know, they had the truth and they weren't going to compromise on that truth because it wouldn't work the same. You wouldn't end up with the same thing.
But to make your message attractive does not mean compromising.
Well, that's what these people are saying, I think. Every one of them.
But not me.
Not you. And you said you threw his book away. You couldn't read it.
But at the end, Hitler's message was very attractive and also very effective. He got viral, you could say.
Yes, finally.
Without
compromising. But he had these huge enemies all along. And they were just planned on how to bring him down eventually. They're good at that, waiting for the right time, you know, not trying to go up against something when it's kind of on the upsurge, but waiting for the right time. So, well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in about Golden Dawn. I hate to put it that way, interesting, like I'm just observing, but I am from afar in my safe seat. But they've obviously got lawyers, you know, and they have to have some defense, you know, they've got to have some lawyers working on their behalf. But let's talk real quick about the election. If you think it makes any difference, you told me you don't follow the politics because, you know, you don't like it and it's all false, and that's true. But do you think that what's going on in Germany with Merkel winning and she's trying to now form a government with social democrats as junior partners has any importance whatsoever?
I told you that I do not have a television, and my participation in the politics of today is very limited. As long as there are only politically correct parties in Germany, in Scandinavia, let's say. As long as only these parties have something to say, it's inconsequential. It's inconsequential, and Merkel's doing a government with social democrats. What does it mean? It's the same
yeah.
thing.
No,
it's the same thing as the
right.
social democrats. Doing a government with the Centrum in 1932 in Germany.
Yeah, the Germans are just no good. You know, the basic Germans, they're just no good anymore. They just go along. They just want their comfort. You know, they had the opportunity to vote for that alternative party, anti-EU party, but they didn't have the guts to do that. They fell short of the 5% needed. They're not going to have any seats. So they just go with the same old stuff. And Merkel's
sure.
just sold out old thing. And it's going to be a terrible 4 years, I think. I think it's going to be worse in the European Union than it has been because she had this election coming up. And it's just there's things happening, but there's a lot that looks very, very bleak because, as we've already pointed out, they have the power. You know,
they have the power and people, as long as they are not hungry, as long as we are not hungry, people are not going to go to the streets.
No, I guess they never do. You know, the churches, religion used to get people going. And a lot of people think, well, we need to get some religious angle in all this. But I don't think so, because it doesn't take you anywhere. I mean, if you got to get people all riled up emotionally via religion, it's not going to do anything in the long run. Well, we're running out of time here, but I wanted to say that you will be continuing, thank goodness, with your website, and I hope, and more people should pass these things around. I'm guilty. I don't even have links on CarolynJaeger.net. I guess I should start putting some on there. But, you know, we need to, and we've got this new revisionist book out that we can focus attention on, and we've got a few other things that have come along new. You know, let me just throw in here that I'm very, very disappointed in this new Iranian president and the things that he was saying lately, trying to, you know, get away from the anti-Holocaust talk of his predecessor. It doesn't sound good to me.
Oh, it's just another example of trying to please the Jews. And you know, Mike Piper says all the time, it's not going to help anybody who once became branded as the enemy of the Jews to say, oh no, I believe in the Holocaust. No, I'm not against the Jews. It doesn't help. He's out.
Iran is out. Yeah, it's not going to help. You know, these people, they're worried about their countries being bombed into oblivion. You almost can't blame them.
It's not only a question of bombing. It's also a question of the economy, which is slowly, you know, crashing in Iran. They have an extreme inflation, and people are suffering. So it was an attempt to begin to get out of it. But as far as we know, our adversaries, we know that such declarations are not going to help.
No, and the criminality of these people. You know, this president, if I have time to say this, he mentioned the taking of human life is contemptible. He was referring to the Germans, you know, the Nazis and the Jews, as well as non-Jews. He said, the taking of human life is contemptible. How often do we hear these people saying that? It's so hypocritical. Human life is taken in huge numbers all the time. And by the people who are saying, you know, that it's contemptible, or by the people who would say that. We've got 60 seconds. We're not going to hear the music. We're not going to hear the cue, so I have to watch for them here. But you know, this kind of talk, it just really gets me. You know, when there's no value of human life in this world by most of these regimes, and certainly by the Jews. It's all hypocrisy. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the program today, and we'll have to do this again in a not wait so long. I hope you will do it again soon. And
thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And we've got our Skype issues straightened out now. And I hope that a lot of people will visit your website. Show a blogger, everybody. And I think now I don't want to be talking into the music, so we'll say good night or goodbye, good day, good afternoon.
Goodbye. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynjaeger.com.